This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Norris Church Mailer's written the book she used to tell her late husband Norman that she never would, a book that talks about him, but a whole lot else, too. The former Barbara Davis of small-town Arkansas tells her story, the granddaughter of a mule skinner who became Little Miss Little Rock, a military wife, a mother teacher, a model, a painter, a contemporary novelist, and now a grandmother who, her grandchildren may one day be fascinated to learn, once dated Bill Clinton and played footsie with Teddy Kennedy and Ole Cassini simultaneously. Norris Church Mailer's memoir is called A Ticket to the Circus. She joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Scott. Actually, I didn't play footsie with Teddy and Oleg. They played footsie with each other.
Yes, tell that story. Thank you, yes.
And they thought it was me. We were at a dinner party. We were laughing and having a great time. Teddy was on one side and Oleg was on the other. And so at a certain point, I excused myself to go to the ladies' room. And they stopped and kind of looked at each other with this funny look on their faces. And then I saw both of them lean down and start fumbling with their shoes. My feet were tucked under my chair, and they had been playing footsie with each other, thinking it was me.
Well, tell us how you met Norman Mailer.
It was one of these coincidences where 10 things have to line up perfectly for this incident to happen, but they all did. Mm-hmm. The first thing that had to happen is I had to forget to send off the card to the Book of the Month Club saying I don't want this expensive book called Marilyn.
And this is Norman Mailer's book about Marilyn.
And the book arrived at my house, and I was like, oh, God, it's $20. I can't really afford it. But I started looking at it, and the pictures were so beautiful, and then I started reading it. And Norman came through Russellville, Arkansas, to visit a friend, Francis Galtney, that he was in the war with. Francis taught at Arkansas Tech, and I was a friend of his. And Francis was giving a cocktail party, and I thought, oh, perfect, I'll go to the cocktail party, I'll get my book signed, and that'll be great. And wound up seeing him that night and going out to dinner, and that's kind of when everything started.
So I have to ask, here he was separated from his fourth wife, living with a woman with whom he had a child, at the same time was having an affair with yet another woman.
Right.
This didn't have winter written all over it.
No, it didn't, did it?
So what swept off your feet?
Well, he did. He was just the most interesting person I'd ever met. And you really can't pick who you're attracted to. You just are. Mm-hmm. And somehow it worked out, and I knew it was going to work out.
Norman Mailer had written, well, several great books, but one I'm thinking of in particular, The Executioner's Song, which brought him into contact with a man he kind of became an advocate for, Jack Henry Abbott.
Oh, yeah.
A career violent criminal. Mm-hmm. His letters to Norman Mailer became the basis of a pretty famous book, In the Belly of the Beast.
Yeah.
Night he got out of prison, he turned up on your doorstep.
He sure did. I didn't know he was getting out of prison until my husband had his coat on, walking out the door to pick him up. And I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to the airport to pick up Jack. And I was like, what? Because I had really been against this whole thing. But Norman did say that he would give him a job as a research assistant and that he would help him. I agreed to have Jack over for dinner. He said, have him for dinner one night, then you'll never have to see him again. And so Jack came for dinner that night and actually was kind of moving. And I guess I liked him more than I thought I would, and I got very involved. And of course, it all ended badly.
In fact, what was it, the night the Sunday Times came out with a rave review of In the Belly of the Beast, Jack Henry Abbott killed an innocent man.
He sure did.
What do you think Norman Mailer was trying to do?
He just thought, I think with the force of his personality, he could make this man into a writer. And once he's a writer, then he's going to be okay. I mean, you can't give up on people. You can't say nothing's ever going to save anybody, so we shouldn't even try. But you can't expect someone who's been in prison his whole entire life to turn around and become a sweet guy who writes books and walks his dog and, you know, has a normal life. It's just not going to happen that way.
For someone who wrote so many true and good lines, the unfortunate quote that I guess he really did utter around the time was, culture is worth a little risk.
Yeah, that was an unfortunate quote. Norman tended to, when he was under pressure, like with people screaming at him, and, you know, he would just kind of throw something out there. And I knew what he was saying. You can't not ever try to save somebody. You can't not ever try to help somebody. But you kind of, you need to weigh it a little more carefully, I think, before you act.
You were living what you recognized as, and what sounds like a blessed, almost blissful life.
Mm-hmm.
And you took care of family finances and you were going over his credit card receipts.
Mm-hmm.
And is it fair to say, let me put it this way, that the old bull had not changed his ways?
The old bull had not changed his ways. I know people think I'm totally stupid. I mean, I was wife number six, and he had all these girlfriends and was famous for being a philanderer. But, when I'd say to him, why didn't I know? He said, it's not hard to fool somebody who loves you and trusts you, which is a really kind of devastating thing to say, but it's absolutely true. I mean, I wasn't looking for problems, and the thing that really made it so believable is that he really did change for a number of years. He wanted to change. He wanted to try monogamy. He'd never done that. He'd always been a philanderer, and he wanted to try living without guilt. He wanted to try living with just one woman to see how deep one could get into a relationship with one person if you didn't have others, if you weren't lying and cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of years, he was really true to me. And then you get lulled into just thinking this is going to go on forever. And as we know, it didn't go on forever.
You wrote a long, extraordinary letter to him, which I'll tell our listeners you have to pay for the book to read.
No, yeah.
Why did you stay?
Oh, Scott, there's times you leave somebody for something like this, but it's not so easy to just, you don't leave a person, you leave your whole life, you leave a family, you leave thousands of little habits, you leave, we had 9 children, we'd been together at that point. We wound up being together almost 33 years, and we were at that point together about 16 years. I was these kids' mother. I had, we had a son of our own who was 14 at the time. To leave an entire life to go to what? To go to nothing, to start all over again, to rent a little apartment and start dating again at this point. I mean, and I didn't want to leave him. I loved him. I was... Of course I was upset about what he did, but he made it very clear that he wanted to change, that he was sorry and that he wasn't going to keep doing it. If he had said to me, sweetheart, I love you, but I can't be true to you because I'm just the way I am and you'll have to accept it, I think I would have left. I couldn't have lived that way, but he made it very clear that he wanted to go back and did want to be true, and he was tired of the philandering and wanted me to forgive him, and he was so sincere that I did.
Norris, you've just been wonderful to talk to. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks, Scott, so much.
Norris Church Mailer, her new book, A Ticket to the Circus. And you can read Norris Church Mailer's description of the moment that she met Norman Mailer in an excerpt from her book, A Ticket to the Circus, at our website, npr.org. And it's time for sports. The British are coming! The British are coming! A couple of them, Ian Poulter and Lee Westwood, are at the top of the leaderboard of the Masters Tournament, but you know what? That duo could be a zillion strokes ahead and still not attract the attention Tiger Woods has by returning to golf at the Masters and playing like he's been in training for 5 months, not seclusion. NPR's Tom Goldman is at the Masters. Hi there, Tom.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And where does Tiger Woods stand going into today's round? How's he playing?
He's tied for third with four other golfers, two shots behind the leaders. He's playing very well. He's very pleased with his performance. He putted poorly in the first round, a first round that happened to be his best opening round ever at Augusta, but he still putted poorly. Yesterday in round two, he said he controlled the flight of the ball well. I know that's an important thing to you, Scott. And he putted much better.
Yeah.
And he putted much better. So he's very happy, especially the fact that he's not only playing well, but he's a contender. And he said as much at his post-round press conference yesterday in a funny kind of duh moment with a reporter.
Do you like your spot on the leaderboard right now?
Yeah, I do. Yes.
Clearly, that wasn't you asking that question, Tom.
No, just the smart ones. Now, Tiger, he's talked a lot about how it was his intense practice sessions that have helped him not miss a beat out here. And I think we're also seeing his supreme talent as a golfer, probably the most talented ever, the ability to come back and lock on immediately. We're also seeing his supreme arrogance in a good and a bad way, Scott. Good in that he has the confidence and belief in himself to do this. Bad in that he continues to say he had to practice extra hard because he didn't have the luxury of playing tournaments during his time away from golf, as if he were being denied the opportunity. As one reporter here said, Tiger buddy, that was your choice to remove yourself from the scene, your choice to get yourself into the little mess you did. No one was denying you. Hmm.
I want to talk about these two British guys, Ian Poulter and Lee Westwood, while we have the chance. And there really has been a whole, forgive the expression, renaissance of the Brits doing very well in international tournaments.
Well, they have, you know, and here's what Lee Westwood would say to you, though, Scott, in that wonderful British way of calling someone a schmuck while sipping a cup of tea and smiling. Not saying I'm calling you that, Scott. But Westwood responded to a reporter who said, is this verification of the British renaissance in golf? He said, if you think that's so, you simply haven't checked the recent world rankings. There are three Brits in the top 10. Westwood is number 4. Poulter's number 7. They're darn good, and they have been trending upward recently, as we say. Poulter is very flamboyant in both his talk and his clothing. He loves more than a hint of color on the golf course. Yesterday, he was resplendent in pink pants, yellow shirt, white shoes with just a little pink stitching.
My exact outfit today.
And his love of natty attire prompted the following question from a reporter.
If you like to make bold fashion statements, what color combination goes well with a green jacket?
What
color combination goes well with a green?
Absolutely anything.
The green jacket, of course, Scott. The green sport coat goes to the winner of the Masters.
Tom, has nobody shouted anything ugly or even just a little bit curious at Tiger Woods as he stalks the course?
No. No, there have been no reports of heckling. Security's been very tight. I've recognized the same security guards walking along in the gallery with Tiger during his rounds. Reportedly, security guards have had mugshots of Tiger's mistresses, so they are ready to pounce, so to speak, if they see someone, particularly in
Forgive
the
Forgive me, that must be quite a collection.
Exactly, you know, like unrolling one of those scrolls. Particularly in the opening press practice rounds when more people were on the course. But no, and you know, Scott, the whole elephant in the room has become a mouse here. There's hardly a mention of the scandal. Just as planned by Team Tiger, you know, we're seeing why he returned to Augusta. Very polite, knowledgeable golf fans here. The patrons, as they're called, are here to see golf and not fuss with all that scandal stuff. Of course, what happens after this bubble of protection at the Masters is anyone's guess.
And, you know, they've given us a few more seconds on the clock, Tom. So there are a lot of players from around the world who are doing very well in this early round, aren't there?
Well, there are. You know, I mentioned the people right behind the leaders, four Americans, Woods and Mickelson and Anthony Kim and Ricky Barnes. Should also mention the South Koreans, Y.E. Yang and K.J. Choi. They're representative. Lots of people from other countries. It certainly is a United Nations of golf, of course, with the English on top right now.
Yeah. Well, may Britannia rules the greens, at least until later this afternoon. NPR's Tom Goldman from the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. April 15th is just ahead, and it makes you recall that Beatles song that may remind us why the colonies had a revolution.
If you drive a car, car,
tax the street.
If you drive to six,
I'll tax your seat.
If you get too cold,
I'll tax the heat.
If you take a walk,
I'll tax your feet.
Taxman
by the Beatles. A.J. Jacobs, who's devoted his career to such trivia, joins us now with some info snacks about taxes. A.J., thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What have you found?
Well, that song is not too far from the truth. One of my favorite taxes in history was the beard tax, which would have devastated the hipster community in Brooklyn right now. Luckily, it is off the books. It was during the reign of Peter the Great in Russia. Mm-hmm. And he actually wanted to westernize Russia and thought that taxing the beards would induce people to shave. And it actually worked. He was a master, though, of taxation. He taxed beehives and chimneys and souls.
You don't mean of shoes, but souls, human souls?
Yeah, S-O-U-L, that's right. And the loophole was women apparently at that time did not have souls. So it was just adult
Ooh.
Males who had souls.
You know, it's interesting you should cite that because I happen to know that while I owe a little bit on my taxes, my soul is due a huge refund. So I hope the IRS takes care of that.
So your soul is set up in the Cayman Islands or something? Smart.
AJ, we have you on the agreement that I make the jokes here. But yes, okay. There was a window tax in 18th century England?
Yes, I thought that this was very interesting. This was actually an attempt to tax the rich. But at that time, it was considered gauche to ask about people's income. So this was a way around that. They figured rich people had large houses with lots of windows. The problem was rich people started building houses with no windows, or they would board up the windows so as not to be taxed. So if you think that British houses are very dark, that might be the reason why.
Most famous tax cheats you can think of.
Probably the most famous was Henry David Thoreau, who refused to pay taxes for moral reasons. He didn't want to support slavery or the Mexican-American War. Mm-hmm. And he was actually caught. They threw him in jail, but he only stayed one night. His aunt paid his taxes, and he was sprung from jail, which I kind of found disappointing, you know, as the self-professed rebel.
Well, he got just enough time in jail to be able to write about it. You can sympathize with that, can't you, AJ?
Yes, I'm very jealous. I usually spend a year on my projects, and he did it in a day. Very impressive.
AJ Jacobs, editor-at-large for Esquire magazine, author of The Know-It-All, One Man's Humble Quest to Become the Smartest Person in the World. He joined us from New York. This is NPR News.
Parents are so boring. They tell me not to do drugs while they gulp martinis. Nobody understands me. I don't feel like I fit in anywhere.
Must be the 1980s. Must be life among young men and women who are coming of age.
Won't you come see about me? I'll be alone. Dancing, you know it, baby. Tell me your troubles and doubts.
The Breakfast Club. Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink were all just some of the films of the 1980s that seemed to express the angst, anger, and anxiety of a new generation that grew up after Woodstock and before YouTube. There was a group of actors used to pop up in one or more of those films, from The Breakfast Club to St. Elmo's Fire. They became known as the Brat Pack. One of the filmmakers who defined that era was John Hughes, who died last year at the age of 59. Just 59. Maybe it's true what one of his characters said. When you grow up, your heart dies. We're joined now from New York by Susanna Gora. Her new book is You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes, and Their Impact on a Generation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And alongside her in New York is the actor who uttered that line when she played Allison in The Breakfast Club, Ally Sheedy. She's also in St. Elmo's Fire. She does TV series today and dazzled critics a few years ago in the independent film High Art. Ally Sheedy, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me too.
And out in Studio City, California, we're joined by Howard Deutsch. He directed two of John Hughes' films, including Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful. Mr. George, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Susanna Gora, that term Brat Pack, where did it come from?
It actually came from a New York Magazine cover story that was written by a journalist named David Blum. He originally was just going to do an article, a small inside piece about Emilio Estevez. And so in the course of doing this piece, he started seeing a story that was more than just about Emilio Estevez, but was about this group of hot young actors in Hollywood. And he had the phrase just kind of came into his head, the Brat Pack, a riff, of course, on the Rat Pack with Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. And the phrase Brat Pack today, I do think, has a kind of romantic, cool tone to it, because in time, the phrase has become an indelible part of pop culture history. But we have to remember that back then, when it first came out, and so many of these actors were stuck with that label, it was a kind of painful and difficult thing to deal with, both personally and professionally.
So, Ally Sheedy, deal with it, please. Did it feel romantic and cool at the time or something else?
It did feel romantic, kind of cloud with these other actors. We're this really cool family. You know, I'm finally popular with these guys. I was not popular in high school. I have some real friends, and we get to work. And all of it was, I was just blissfully happy, and I really do love those people. Then when the article came out, it was really, we all were somewhat blindsided. I didn't know enough at that point to know that sometimes things go in cycles and that you can do really well and then there'll be a kind of a whip around. I'm not going to say backlash because it's not really right, but it just things will turn and then they go down and then they can come up again. And I didn't have that kind of – I wasn't old enough to actually understand that. So when it happened, I felt like this is the end. There were shock waves and people stopped hanging out together and it had a huge impact.
Howard Deutsch, Molly Ringwald wrote just the nicest recollection of John Hughes when, alas, he died last year. Did they have a special kind of creative chemistry?
No doubt. John saw in Molly, you know, the perfect actress, but Pretty in Pink in particular.
So what am I supposed to do? He asked me out, and I like him. If I hate him because he's got money, just listen to me. If I hate him because he's got money, that's the exact same thing as them hating us because we don't. Do you understand?
The studio wanted us to audition or interview other actresses, and I never, ever really could imagine anyone else. But yes, Molly and John had special chemistry.
Do I have this right? It seems to me I've read that she was the one who introduced him to some of the British rock groups like Simple Minds and Psychedelic Furs that wound up having such significant roles in his films.
I don't think that's actually quite right. I think what it was he was always a major music head. I mean, even as a teenager, he loved the Beatles. And as a grown man, he always wrote scripts with music playing, and he often came up with the idea for a film soundtrack before he even wrote the script. So I think, I don't know that so much she was introducing him to those bands because he was so plugged into that British new wave scene. But I think it was more they had a shared passion for music.
Caroline laughs when it's raining all day.
And it's also Pretty in Pink movie lore that she introduced him to the song Pretty in Pink by the Psychedelic Furs. And I asked her about that, and she said she couldn't imagine that he wouldn't have known about that song. But she said that perhaps her love of the song helped him kind of listen to the song in a new way.
We're speaking with Susanna Gora, Ally Sheedy, and director Howard Deutsch about the Brat Pack and the life and work of, principally about the life and work of the late John Hughes. Howard Deutsch, could you tell us about, I gather, these writing frenzies he went into?
Sure, yeah. When he was doing rewrites on Some Kind of Wonderful, I'd go over to his house late at night when he wrote and music blasting, and he'd be chain smoking and kind of that image, and I'd usually fall asleep around 1 in the morning on the couch. One night, I woke up, and he handed me 50 pages. And as I looked at it, it said on the title page, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So he had written in about 6 hours the first half of Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Jeff, any idea? Boy, this has been a question over the past 25 years. Why did John Hughes stop making films?
You know, I can only tell you that my personal experience is that he was not happy living in Los Angeles. And I think he also was tired of the criticism and the critiques of the films, which didn't always get... I mean, there's a revisionist history. In retrospect, a lot of these movies, we're discussing them now, are held up as iconic movies. At the time, a lot of reviewers did not like them. Mm-hmm. And he was sensitive about that.
Susanna Gora?
Yes.
I'm so glad Howard Deutsch mentioned that we have a kind of rosy glow of the John Hughes films in era now, but there was plenty of criticism at the time. Why do you think his films have lasted and endured?
Well, he was smart enough to take teenagers and their problems seriously. Like Molly Ringwald's character in Pretty in Pink, I always had the feeling her after-school job at the record store helped keep food on the table in her house. So he really understood that in order to connect with teenagers, you got to have a lot of drama and a lot of melodrama. And he was smart enough to know who's more dramatic than teenagers.
Why can't you just forget her?
It's late. You got school.
No, don't walk out on this. Will you please just listen to me? Please?
I've already been through this, Andy.
Sure, you go through it every day. You're still going through it. Why can't you just realize that she's gone and she's not going to come back?
Ally Sheedy, may I ask, is it hard for a Brat Packer to grow up?
Yes and no. It's a mixed bag. One of the things that I guess has happened because of Breakfast Club being so loved and, as it turns out, not seeming to be dated, somewhat timeless. And I only know that because my daughter's 16 and the kids in high school are watching The Breakfast Club, which I find kind of crazy. And not a day goes by, I have to tell you, where I don't hear somebody come up to me and tell me that they were Allison in The Breakfast Club. Literally not a single day. These are people who run the spectrum in race and even sex. There are a lot of guys who come up to me and tell me they were Allison. And maybe because it's New York, I don't know.
I was going to gently suggest that. But
it's great. I mean, that's you know, forgive me for sounding too sugary, but there's a blessing-like thing going on there. I mean, it's something that's just kept going, and I'm really grateful for that. And I think not as difficult for me these days, because it just enough times passed. I'm in my 40s. It doesn't really matter. But for a while there in my 30s, it was tough because I was so identified with that one role.
Howard Deutsch, or Susanna, anybody, do you think there are more John Hughes writings or even films to come?
I can jump in and answer that, Scott, because I was privileged to go to the funeral. And after the funeral, Nancy Hughes, they had invited me back to their house, and John Hughes Jr. asked me to come into the room, the writer's room, where John had done a lot of his work in the last 10 years. And I got to tell you, there were diaries and journals and scripts and books piled up to the ceiling. I'd never seen anything like it. He, as Ally said, never stopped writing. And so I think it's up to the family and what they want to do about that. I mean, for instance, John said to me years ago, we should do a Broadway play of Pretty in Pink. I never did anything with it, but the family's considering what they want to do. Mostly, though, I think it's important to say that they mostly want to honor the writing and the integrity and the originality of John by not making those decisions based on anything, but if it's the right thing for the particular project.
At least a couple of you there seem to, at one point or another, know John Hughes' mind pretty well. What song do you think he'd like us to go out of in this interview?
Changes, David Bowie.
Oh, cha-cha-cha-cha. Yeah.
Yep.
I think we can do that.
Good choice.
I think that's the one.
Thanks so much. So wonderful talking to all of you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susanna Gora and Ally Sheedy joined us from New York. Ms. Gora is the author of You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes and Their Impact on a Generation. Howard Deutsch joined us from his home in Studio City, California.
Changes. Turn and face the strain. Changes. Don't want to be a richer man. Changes. Turn and face the strain. Changes. It's going to have to be a different man.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
I watch the ripples change the size, but never leave the
stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children.